Introduction to Lesson Number 7, covering chapters 15, 16, and 17. Chapter 15 continues with the pathway of the king in his rejection, and records some interesting incidents for our instruction. First, there is the controversy with the religious critics regarding freedom from tradition. Then the commendation for the Canaanitish woman regarding her expression of faith. And finally the compassion of the Lord for the great company, and his feeding them with food convenient. The tradition of the Pharisees was such that it displaced the authority of the Word of God and placed all the importance upon the teaching of men. A study of this section will convince the reader that the controversy ranges around tradition when opposed to truth. Externals instead of internals. The hand instead of the heart. The critical question asked by the Pharisees leads to a message of condemnation to the critics. A word of explanation to the multitude and an exhortation to his disciples. The Pharisees are condemned because that by their traditions they nullify the law of God. They were extremely particular regarding the traditions of hand washing, but unfortunately their hearts were not right with God. A man may be bound in the grave clothes of tradition and be as lifeless as a corpse. It takes the Word of God to bring freedom to men. The Lord takes this occasion to give a word of explanation to the multitude, and in so doing he explains what it is that causes a man to be defiled. Not the vessels out of which we eat, or even the food we eat, for these are material things and have to do with the body, but the things that proceed from the inside, that is, from the heart, and expressed by the lips, these can defile a man. These teachings caused offense to the self-righteous Pharisees, and the disciples said so to the Lord, which led to an exhortation from the Lord to the disciples. While giving an extended explanation to the disciples regarding how a person is defiled, he also gives the exhortation, "Let them alone. Why interfere? If blind people decide to remain blind, and are content to be led by blind leaders, then let them alone." At this point, we reach another occasion when it is said, "Then Jesus went hence and departed." The next incident deals with the Canaanitish woman and her faith. This woman did not belong to the house of Israel like the Pharisees, yet she approached the Lord, calling upon him as the son of David, and beseeching him for mercy. She had no national rights in Israel, being a Gentile and considered unclean, but at least she had some perception and a good faith. If she didn't understand her position, she at least understood her condition, and had faith to believe that this man could meet her need, even if the disciples were not in sympathy with her. Her manner of approach may not be right, but she came to the Lord the best way she knew. And when the truth was made known to her, she willingly took her rightful place as a Gentile dog, but begged for the crumbs that the children let fall. This was granted, and the Lord gave the word of commendation, "O woman, great is thy faith." Following this incident, we again meet with the expression, "Jesus departed." And so he moves to another area. Then the record of his compassion for the hungry multitude and his feeding of these faint and tired people. They never asked him to do this, and we may well question if they expected him to do it. But since he had fed the multitude who were within the covenant of Israel, now he demonstrates his compassion for others also, and supplies the need of those who may be considered outsiders. Chapter 16 opens with a joint conspiracy of the ritualists and the rationalists in an endeavor to discredit the Lord by asking him to give a sign from heaven. The idea is that his miracles prove nothing beyond the ordinary, or that people who were under the power of Satan could perform such miracles. But if he really was the Messiah, then why not do something spectacular and show some great sign from heaven? Men who normally were at variance with one another now form a league to oppose Christ, and so they agree on this one thing, that they are against Christ. At this point, the Lord speaks forth their condemnation by exposing their hypocrisy and wickedness and immorality. And then he left them and departed. Following his word of condemnation to the Pharisees and the Sadducees, he speaks a word of caution to his disciples concerning the teaching of these two parties. The Lord likens their teaching to leaven. And keeping in mind the corrupting influence of leaven, we would do well to remember this word of caution, because the principle still applies today, and ritualism with rationalism are still at variance to the truth as taught in the Word of God. Commencing with verse 13 of chapter 16, we have arrived at the great divide, because that from the beginning, Matthew has presented his evidence to prove that this Jesus is the Christ. But what is the measure of apprehension by his people? Do they recognize him? So now he begins to ask some important questions and to unfold to his disciples a number of revelations. The great question centers around the person of Christ. One would do well to note the different titles that are used in this section. Who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am? While the answers that are given would suggest that the people did recognize him as some special person, nevertheless they fail to grasp who he really is. But this leads to the personal question, but whom say ye that I am? The answer to this question, as given by Peter, introduces the first revelation, which is a revelation concerning Christ as being the Son of God. Peter did not learn this truth by education or by intuition, but by revelation from the Father in heaven. One would do well to study what is involved in the titles Son of Man, the Christ, Son of God. After the revelation concerning the person of Christ, there follows the revelation concerning the church. This revelation comes after the confession of Peter and leads to the special confession announced to Peter. If the people of that day were confused in regard to the king and the kingdom, it appears that the people of this day are just as much confused regarding this revelation concerning the church and the keys of the kingdom. Nowhere does it say that Peter received the keys of the church. Such teaching is Roman Catholic heresy. Nor yet does it say that he used the first key on the day of Pentecost and the second key in the house of Cornelius. Rather consider the keys as, first of all, giving a true understanding of things pertaining to the kingdom. Or it could suggest the idea of being granted the liberty of citizenship. But certainly it carries the idea of being the emblem of authority and responsibility. If we project our thoughts forward to the time when the kingdom shall be brought into effect, then surely there will be a heavenly as well as an earthly aspect to this kingdom. And the apostles, including Peter, will definitely have some place of administrative office under the righteous rule of the Lord. But now another problem must be faced. How can this church be brought into being? That leads to the revelation concerning the cross. And from that time Jesus began to show unto them the need for his rejection and crucifixion, and how he would rise again from the dead. At this point we should recapture the opening statement of the book. The son of David, the son of Abraham. The son of David would occupy the throne, but the son of Abraham would go to the altar, then become heir of all things. He has been presented as son of David, but is now on the path of rejection. And like the son of Abraham, makes his way to the place of sacrifice. So we move toward Calvary. From this point, Matthew will take us step by step to the cross. But we must keep in mind that the disciple is not greater than his master. And in association with him, each one will also be identified with the cross. Then a further revelation is given concerning his coming again. But please note the coming referred to at the end of chapter 16 is not the rapture of the church, as set forth in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, but rather the coming of the Son of Man, And this title associates him with earth. And this coming corresponds with the prophecy of Zechariah chapter 14. The world's antagonism may continue against Christ, but the day will come when he shall reign in righteousness. So it is better to be rejected by the world now and await the day of his power. The closing verse of chapter 16 is an introduction to chapter 17 with the Mount of Transfiguration. This transfiguration scene is a beautiful prefiguring of the kingdom. John, who was one of the privileged disciples on the Mount, refers to it as beholding his glory, the glory of the only begotten of the Father. Peter describes the scene as being eyewitnesses of his majesty when we were with him in the Holy Mount. The transfiguration is recorded in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And each record should be read and studied in order to obtain the full report of incidents associated with it. A few suggestions may help the student in his studies. First of all, it is evident that when Christ is manifested in his kingdom, he will be seen in a body of brilliant glory. Then in association with him will be those who are represented by Moses and Elijah. That is, the law and the prophets from the Old Testament, along with those of the New Era, as represented by Peter, James, and John. There will be a combination of people gathered around the person of the glorified Christ, those who had died and had been raised, along with those who had been translated without seeing death, and others who were still on earth, some from earth and some from heaven, but all identified with Christ. The voice that they heard made it perfectly clear that Jesus was the Son of God and superior to the best of men, and all the glory must be given to him. Peter was so enraptured at the scene that he decided that it must be made permanent there and then and allow them to remain on the Mount of Glory. But in the meantime, it is obscured by a cloud, and Peter is taught that what he saw was a prefiguring of the coming glory. But until that day dawn, it is our responsibility to listen to the voice that speaks from heaven. That is the word of God, and obey the word of the Lord. The remainder of chapter 17 deals with the topic of Elijah in relation to the king and the kingdom, and the trial of a man with a demon-possessed son, and finally the question of paying temple tribute. The passage dealing with Elijah gives an important aspect to the fulfillment of prophecy. That is, it may have a smaller circle within a larger circle of fulfillment. If they had received John with his message, then the prophecy could have been fulfilled, for he filled the role of Elijah in whose spirit he came. But since he was rejected and slain, the prophecy awaits its final fulfillment, when Elijah shall actually precede the Messiah before the millennial kingdom is established. Coming down from the mountain, the disciples soon learn that the kingdom is not yet established, because they are met by a man calling for help from his demon-possessed son. Here is a picture of the powerlessness of humanity without Christ, when even the disciples were helpless and unable to cast out this demon. However, in the midst of a perverse and faithless generation, the Lord teaches the potentialities of faith and prayer. The closing section deals with the payment of temple tribute, and Christ as the Son of God could claim exemption. But in his grace he will not embarrass Peter, and suggest that they do not offend the others. So he waives his rights, and provides the tribute for himself and Peter.